Hello, everybody, and welcome to I Eat Green with Bhavani. It's another beautiful Thursday morning on the Progressive Radio Network. Even though it's a bit cloudy and rainy, it's still a beautiful Thursday morning, and I'm so glad to be here with all of you. I have a great show planned for you today. I have chef and author Bryant Terry joining me on in a little bit, talking about his new book, Afro-Vegan. And but before I invite him on, of course, I want to talk to you about some of the things going on in and around the city and some things you can do to take action and get involved in things that are going on. Last night, I want to share with you, I saw a great film, documentary film at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. It was called The Garden. And this film was about the largest community garden in the country that was in South Central L.A., and it was almost like a gift from the city to people after the 1992 riots that took place in L.A., and it was almost like a peace offering. And they gave this parcel of land, 14 acres, to the community in South Central L.A., and over years, they transformed this property that was, you know, really just a, I don't know, an open lot of dirt into a vibrant, beautiful garden with papaya trees and banana trees. And I mean, it was like acres and acres. So it wasn't just like a little community garden with vegetables. I mean, they had trees and they had been established and had been around for a long time. And then in early 2000, they sold that land from under the people. And sold it back to the original owner who they had bought it from when they first gave it away. And there was something going on under the table behind the back door that people were not talking about, something that did not smell right. And these people band together and got lawyers, and it really looked like they were going to turn the decision around and be able to keep their land. But unfortunately, it ended up not going in their favor, and they had to give up their community garden. But watching how this community garden transformed this community brought tears to my eyes and like a grin from cheek to cheek. It was just such a lovely film, seeing these people so happy doing what they loved and feeling so connected to their to the land and to their traditions and roots. And it was really beautiful, and I'm sure I'll talk a little bit with my guest today about growing food, and that connection that people have to their traditions and their land. And so this film was just really beautiful. And if you get a chance to see The Garden, I highly, highly recommend it. Lots of things going on in the news. Of course, you know, the reality of global warming is here, and there's a lot of concern of the oceans rising with the polar melt. And you know, there's just so much information out there on the net that you can go a little bit crazy. But there's petitions to sign, and there's things that, you know, you really want to know about. I mean, they're talking about the rising oceans and how, you know, by the end of this, you know, at the end of this century, it could raise another 3 feet. That's a lot. That, you know, think of all the cities that are right on the coast. It would just decimate them, and people would have to move inland. And so we really need to take this issue of global warming seriously and everyone do their part and what they can do. And one thing that has come up over and over again that everyone can do is improve their diets and go towards a plant-based diet, which would help the greenhouse gas emissions a lot. The industrial food system that we all participate in, or that many of us participate in, is one of the largest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. So by going towards a plant-based diet, you're doing your part. So keep that in mind. The USDA also announced that they have $78 million available for local food enterprises, and that's pretty exciting. You know, you can find out information about it on the Rural Development website, the USDA's Rural Development website. If you have any great ideas that will help your local agriculture. Also, the first ever study reveals that the amount of food dyes in brand name foods is really bad for you. Hello. That's not something that would be obvious to someone paying attention, but the food coloring and the additives that they put into our kids' food is really, really bad. And there's a new study that came out that really talks about how bad it is and how much is in predominantly like cereals, for instance, Trix or Captain Crunch's. Oops, I never even heard of that one before. Anyway, the bright, beautiful colors that get your kids to eat the cereal, well, you're better off not getting your kids to eat that cereal and giving them a whole grain cereal that's really going to nourish them, that's free of GMOs, free of lots of sugars, and certainly free of artificial coloring. So give that some thought next time you're in the market buying cereal for your kids. And then there's some petitions I'd like to encourage you all to sign. We want to tell the Environmental Protection Agency to stop allowing toxic chemicals into everything. You know, years ago when, in 2008, you know, when the country woke up to the fact that BPA was in our water bottles and in kids' toys, it's a cancer-causing endocrine disruptor that was in plastics. There was a huge public outcry to that, and they came out with PBA alternatives. However, the way the EPA works is everything's allowed to be put in until proven bad, rather than doing testing first. So they substituted another chemical into the plastics, and now they're finding that that could possibly be even worse. So this petition on my website is to tell the EPA not to let chemical companies approve chemicals, or for the EPA to approve chemicals into plastics and things that consumers use without testing first. I mean, it just seems like, you know, good business 101 to test first, not after. So please sign that petition. There's also a petition to sign to try to ask the Department of Environmental Conservation to do an environmental impact review of the transporting of crude oil here in New York State, but I would guess that this is going on across the country in all kinds of states. You know, the pipeline we've talked about a lot, and the Keystone Pipeline, and trying to keep that from happening. But what they're doing right now is they're also transporting this crude oil through railroad cars, and there's been derailings, and there's been accidents, and, you know, they're just not really researching all the negative impacts that this could have on the areas should something really disastrous happen. So there's a petition to ask you to do that. And then, of course, we all were thrilled a couple weeks ago when Vermont was the first state to make mandatory labeling of GMOs a law. And as we expected, Monsanto is now suing, along with the Grocery Manufacturers Association. So there's a big push to fight that and to let Monsanto know and the Grocery Manufacturers Association know that we do not support them preventing us from transparency and knowing what's in our foods. And one of the biggest ways we can affect them is in their pocket. And so there's a big push to divest from Monsanto, just like there's also a big push to divest from all fossil fuel companies. And these are ways that we as individuals and consumers and informed citizens can take action. And so I am actually sponsoring with a woman from Morgan Stanley a socially responsible investing farm-to-table dinner. I'm not positive the date yet, so keep checking back, but socially responsible investing is a really up-and-coming, should have been around for years, but it's a way of, you know, doing stuff with your money, your savings for your retirement, but not investing in companies that go against your moral and ethical codes, and that's really important. So learning about socially responsible investing is really important, and I'm happy to say that this was our first year really doing it, and we outperformed, you know, most of the other funds that this organization had. So I was really happy about that. Okay, so before I invite Brian Terry on, I would like to give you a recipe. I want to share a recipe, and I just want you to all know I really appreciate your feedback. It's always so nice to hear how many people are enjoying these recipes that I put out every week. And, you know, keep those comments coming. I love hearing from all of you. Okay, the vegetable fried rice. You know, one of the reasons I'm sharing this with you is because I've been doing demos for parents, and a lot of the questions I get are, you know, what can we give our kids as snacks that is healthy, savory as opposed to sweet, but it's really quick and easy. And I encourage everybody, whenever you're making brown rice, always make a bunch of extra cups, depending on the size of your family. Having brown rice, organic brown rice in the refrigerator that you can just pull out is just such a great time-saving trick. And so you can whip up a vegetable fried rice in literally under 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, if you have all the things in your refrigerator. So 2 cups of short grain brown rice, 4 cups of boiling water, 1 organic gluten-free bouillon cube or vegetable stock you can use instead of the water, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon olive oil, 1 small onion, 4 cloves of garlic, 1 tablespoon grated ginger, 1/2 napa cabbage chopped, 2 carrots small diced, 1 bok choy chopped, 1 cup of snow peas, 5 eggs beaten, 1/2 cup of frozen organic peas, and 1/2 cup of frozen organic corn. If you have fresh, great, of course. 2 tablespoons of tamari, which is a wheat-free soy sauce, so that this whole dish is gluten-free. 2 teaspoons of dark sesame oil, 1 tablespoon of mirin, and that's aji mirin, that's a sweet rice wine, and sesame seeds for garnish. So you're basically going to cook the rice. You bring the water to a boil. You know, you can saute the rice first in a little bit of olive oil, and then add the boiling water, lower the heat, and simmer the rice for about 40 minutes. And like I said, if you already have the rice cooked in the fridge, that saves a lot of time. Saute the onions and carrots in some olive oil with some garlic and ginger for 5 minutes. Add the greens, the bok choy, the napa cabbage. And also let me just say that you can switch around the vegetables if you don't want bok choy or napa cabbage, but you have broccoli and green beans or asparagus in the refrigerator. That's all great, too. So really any vegetables you want, you can use for this. Once the vegetables are soft, I add the eggs. And because I don't like dirtying more than one pan if I don't have to, I actually, after the vegetables are soft, I push the vegetables to the side of my wok and create space in the bottom of the wok. And that's where I make sure there's a little bit of oil in there. And I add the eggs into the center of the wok, and I scramble those first before they coat the vegetables so that the eggs really get a nice scramble on them. Then I add the peas, the snow peas, and the corn. Then I add the rice, the tamari, and the mirin, and mix it all together. And at the very end, I season it with some of the dark sesame oil, and that gives it the real sesame flavor. You can also put a peanut sauce on this. You can put a tahini sauce on this. You really can do so much with it. But the idea is to just quickly stir-fry the vegetables, add the rice, and season it with the tamari, the mirin, and dark sesame oil, and you have a delicious, quick, easy snack, side dish, or add more vegetables, and you have a main course as well. You can also, of course, add tofu, seitan, tempeh to this, and make it a full meal. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce Bryant Terry. He is a national leader in the movement to promote healthy eating. Bryant Terry is the author of many cookbooks, The Inspired Vegan and the critically acclaimed Vegan Soul Kitchen. His new book, Afro-Vegan, which I have right here on the counter with me, it's so great. It's really inspiring. It's inspired from the foods from the Caribbean, the North and South American and African food traditions with a healthy plant-based twist. Along with Anna Lappe, Brian also co-authored Grub, which the New York Times called ingenious. He's the host of Urban Organic, a multi-episode web series that he co-created. Brian's work has been featured in the New York Times, Gourmet, Food and Wine, Oprah, Yoga Journal, Vegetarian Times, and on and on. He's made dozens of national television and radio appearances, including Martha Stewart, Emerald Green, Splendid Table, and now I Eat Green. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today, Brian Terry, seems to be missing in action. He's not coming on. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about his book, and hopefully sometime before the end of the show he will join us. But if not, I have a lot to share about this book because I've had the pleasure of having it with me in the kitchen, and it's really, really a wonderful book. One of the reasons I know Brian Terry wrote this book is because he really realized that the, that the food crisis epidemic of childhood obesity and diabetes has really been hitting the African-American population more than most, and it's really in epidemic proportions. And so the plant-based diet is one way that they can really help get that health crisis in check, but also because he realized that there's a big disconnect in people with their history and their food traditions, and that's not only with the African-American culture, that's with our culture in general. Our food culture in America is such a melting pot that people don't really have these food traditions. And most people in my generation, you know, in the mid-50s, 60, you know, our mothers were, you know, growing up in the 50s and feeding us. And there was this new revolution of, you know, women's rights and freedom, and they didn't want to be stuck in the kitchen. And so all the processed and canned foods that was being offered to them was freedom to them. They did not really realize that the long-term effects of what this food would be doing to all of us and to their children. If they did, I'm sure they wouldn't have gone down that path. But nevertheless, they stopped cooking. And so many of us grew up not seeing our mothers in the kitchen and cooking, or fathers in the kitchen and cooking, but getting used to, you know, opening a can of vegetables, pulling something out of the freezer. I remember the big treat when my parents went out was, you know, TV dinners or a chicken pot pie. We just thought that was the best. And so, you know, the American diet doesn't really have food traditions. So Brian Terry's idea of going back to his roots to really try to connect the African-American people with the foods from their traditions just made so much sense. And he grew up in Tennessee, I think he said. But he grew up, you know, where his grandparents did farm, and, you know, they had a lot of family meals, and he grew up, you know, loving and eating lots of these foods. So for him, okra and black-eyed peas, they were, you know, in his tradition. And right now, he is, you know, wrote this book so that he can really try to reconnect people to those foods. I'm so happy he is going to be joining us in a minute. I guess there was just some confusion there. But anyway, one of the things that I loved about this book as I was going through it were some of the concoctions that are made up at the very beginning with spices and sauces, and there's lots of, you know, really, really interesting concoctions, spice mixtures that he uses in a lot of the cooking. That is not something that is traditional to our cooking, and that brings the full flavors into a lot of the foods. Another thing that he uses a lot is okra and black-eyed peas, and okra is a vegetable that very often is a difficult one for many people to like because it has a slimy texture, and lots of people don't like that. So hopefully the studio is calling him right now, and Bryant will be on with us in just a moment. Okay, so one of the recipes in this book that just looked absolutely great were these crunchy bean and okra fritters with a mango habanero hot sauce. And, you know, one of the things when you're cooking black-eyed peas is you really have to take the skins off of them, which takes quite a bit of time, but it's really worth it. And it's similar to the chickpeas. I don't know how many of you have worked with chickpeas, but when you soak chickpeas overnight, the skins kind of separate, and the black-eyed peas are similar. And to make this these fritters, you actually soak the black-eyed peas overnight, and then you blend them in a food processor, pulse them with some of the other ingredients to make a really smooth paste. And then he adds this very thinly sliced okra to that mixture and fries them. And, you know, he talks about deep frying. I mean, it's deep frying, especially if you're eating a plant-based diet, it's not something that you eat all the time. But as a treat, I mean, nobody can deny how good fried food is. So, you know, it's like a great hors d'oeuvre, great party food. So these fritters are really, you know, that celebration of really good food. So let's just hold 1 minute while we get Bryant on the air. Bryant, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us. I'm sorry for any confusion that happened this morning, but I'm so glad you can make it. I love your new book. It's beautiful.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's really great. I was wondering if you could share with everybody a little bit about your history. Like, did you know you always wanted to be a chef, and did you always know you wanted to be a vegan chef? When did you decide that you wanted to be a vegan chef?
Well, you know, the thing is, I've always cooked. I grew up in a family that really prized food. You know, we had farms in rural Mississippi and Tennessee, and then when my grandparents moved to Memphis in their teens, they brought with them the agrarian knowledge, the desire to grow food and just be connected to the land. And so we had, dare I say, urban farms in the city. My grandfather practically had a farm. He had chickens, he had a pig, he had, you know, a wide variety of vegetables and fruits that he was growing. So food's always been important to me, but my in terms of my kind of background with doing this work as an adult, I actually started out as a grassroots activist working with young people in New York City because I was deeply concerned about the reality that this generation is at risk of having a shorter lifespan than our parents' generation. So I really wanted to make some type of intervention, and I decided to go to cooking school in order to start an organization that used cooking, that used food as a way to engage young people and really get them excited about shifting their relationship with health and food.
Uh-huh. So, and did you go to the Natural Gourmet cooking school? Is that why you were vegan, or you went to regular cooking school and then the vegan part came later?
No, I went to the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, which is based in New York City. It's the oldest health supportive cooking school, so they do a lot of focus on different color eating models and cooking models that are all about, you know, using food as healing, from macrobiotic to raw food to vegetarian and veganism. But in terms of my own personal journey with veganism, that started when I was in high school. I heard this song Beef by the hip-hop group Boogie Down Productions and KRS-One, and was so taken aback by the reality of what is happening in our industrial food system and the way that animals are treated in factory farms. And I decided that I didn't want to be a part of that. So I started my journey with veganism. And, you know, in terms of the food that I, you know, was presenting with the young people and Be Healthy, the initiative that I started and with the cookbook writing that I do, I really focus on, you know, vegan, plant-centered, vegetable-forward food, because I see that as a way to help address this public health crisis that we're seeing among Americans in general, but particularly by those the communities most impacted by preventable diet-related illnesses, low-income communities of color. And so I just want people to have some type of, you know, tool that allows them to enjoy foods that might be familiar to them, foods that are, you know, they might imagine as their own cultural foods, but that are, you know, kind of a little more health supportive, a little lighter, and a little more, you know, vegetable centered.
Mm-hmm. I was, you know, looking at the book, and I know okra is one of the, you know, real traditional foods that you focus on, and I know you mentioned this in the book, that many people have an aversion to okra because of its sliminess.
Yeah.
What do you do to combat that? Do you have a way of preparing it that takes away some of that sliminess, or do you use the sliminess to enhance the recipe and go from there?
You know, it just depends, because there are ways of preparing okra that actually, you know, prevents it from being as slimy, such as grilling it, which is actually one of my favorite ways to have okra. You know, I'll wash it really well, pat it dry with a clean kitchen towel, toss it in some olive oil with a little black pepper and a little coarse sea salt, and then put it on skewers and grill it until it, you know, it has like some marks on it and it's starting to get tender. And then I'll just squeeze lemon juice on it. So it's really simply prepared, allows the vegetable to shine, and you don't get all that sliminess. The sliminess can be useful. You know, one of okra is actually one of the central ingredients. Like the word okra, so people use gumbo, and okra means gumbo. I think it's the Manubu word, king gumbo, in Central Africa is, you know, where we get gumbo that's cooked in Louisiana. And it's, you know, that sliminess actually gives the gumbo like a nice base, and the broth some thickness. So it's used as a thickener. And so I think there is a place for it. One tip that I use to help make okra less slimy is actually washing it. If you cut it and then you start to rinse it before you cook it, you'll see that a lot of that gelatinous, viscous liquid that comes out of it is starting to wash off. So I wash it sometimes maybe 10 times just to help get some of that sliminess off. But, you know, okra, yeah. But the thing about okra is that it's actually an ingredient that, you know, is used to help combat hypertension. You know, foods that are rich in potassium, like oranges, bananas, okra, potato, you know, things of that nature. Many physicians or naturopaths or, you know, whatever type of medical practitioner suggest adding more okra to the diet because, you know, potassium is an important mineral that helps promote healthy blood pressure levels. And so, you know, I tell people that, you know, so given that African Americans have some of the highest rates of hypertension, you know, I often tell people that, hey, this is like a food that's indigenous to Africa, that's kind of like central to African American cuisine, and it's great for combating one of the, you know, diseases that plagues African Americans more than any other community.
Mm-hmm. What other foods have you discovered that were really traditional foods that came out of Africa that also nutritionally have a lot of benefit for people's health?
Well, you know, I have a section in the book that is actually dedicated to three of the ingredients that historians agree traveled from the African continent to the Americas through the transatlantic slave trade, most likely. Okra, or, you know, not necessarily transatlantic slave trade, probably in different food crop exchanges as well, but okra, watermelon, and what's the other one?
Black eyed peas.
Yeah. And uh-huh. Those are, you know, three of the ingredients that I really like to focus on, and just helping people think about these is this kind of thread that connects us to Western Central Africa. And, you know, I love all three of those ingredients for different reasons. We talked about okra with watermelon. You know, it's a complicated relationship that I think African Americans have historically had with that fruit because of many of the racial stereotypes that were, you know, kind of attributed to African Americans and their relationship with watermelon throughout the, you know, late 19th and 20th century. And, but it's a great, I mean, it's like, it's delicious, it's flavorful, it's very hydrating. You know, one of the things that I often remind people of is the need to eat foods that are in season. You know, I think we kind of get caught up in like all these different criteria for what's healthy and what's good for us. But, you know, some things are just natural and built into the way that the Mother Nature is operating, and that's eating seasonally. And, you know, during the summer where it's warmer, where we're sweating more, where we actually need to be hydrated and drinking lots more water and eating foods that are high in, you know, liquid content, you know, watermelon is one of those. That's why, you know, in the summer there are more cucumbers and, you know, things like watermelon and just fruits and vegetables that have a higher water content to help us stay hydrated. And it's so versatile. I mean, everything from just eating slices of watermelon sprinkled with, I actually do a little mixture of basil and sea salt, and, you know, like the, I like to mix fresh herbs with sea salt and then use it in creative ways. But so I'll make basil, sea salt, and sprinkle that on the watermelon. When I was growing up, I never got why some of the older people would sprinkle a little salt on the watermelon before eating it. But now I understand that that salty flavor helps bring out some of the sweetness of the watermelon, and then the basil just really lifts it up and makes it pop.
Salt is so great. You know, I think I'm sure you know of the watermelon salad that people use with feta cheese, and I think this, you know, it's not vegan,
yes,
obviously, but the feta cheese has that saltiness also, and that's one of the reasons
exactly
it pairs so well.
Yeah, in that same spirit. I mean, I'll take the watermelon and blend it in my Vitamix and then strain the juice and do kind of like an agua fresca with a little, you know, sweetener, or I'll just drink the watermelon juice plain. I'll take, you know, one of the things that I love doing, and this is a tip that I, you know, I have this whole thing around zero waste cooking where you try to use as many parts of the fruits and vegetables as possible before composting as a way to practice eco-sustainability, and pickled watermelon rind. This is a traditional Southern way of using, you know, the rind of the watermelon by simply peeling off the outer green layer and then boiling it in like a simple syrup with fresh herbs and spices, and it is a tasty snack. And you can actually, like, use a traditional canning method, and then it will sit for months on end. And that's what a lot of people used to do. They would just, like, take a lot of the watermelon rinds from the summer, pickle them, and then just have them in their pantry along with other preserves and pickles and things that, you know, can be eaten during the later times of the winter.
Wow. I've never heard of that. That sounds great. Because you're right. That takes up so much room in the compost, all that rind. And yeah, it'd be great to do something with it. Now, there's a lot of different grains that I know, you know, come out of Africa as well that are not traditional in our country, such as teff, sorghum. You use some of those in this book. I know there's the teff biscuits, and I saw another teff one. What about sorghum? Do you use sorghum too? And I don't see that here.
You know, I have used and often use sorghum syrup at home. I don't use the grain. I often lean towards millet. But in terms of, you know, sorghum syrup, it's one of those kind of old school traditional Southern like sweeteners. And I remember growing up and my grandmother would make biscuits from scratch every weekend, and we would eat them with either maple syrup or sorghum. We'd sop them up,
really?
Up the syrup with that, that sorghum syrup. And so I found a place in the South that I actually order it from and have it delivered, because it's kind of hard to get sorghum syrup for whatever reason, you know, outside of the South, and even, you know, kind of like generally in the South, I don't think it's that widely available. But I found some online resources where I actually have it shipped to California. And, you know, when I'm in the mood, when I want to just have that kind of family memory of eating with my grandparents in their home in South Memphis, I will make some teff biscuits and then sop up some sorghum syrup with them.
Wow. Wow, the Teff biscuits look really beautiful, and you know, I was interested. I'm not familiar with Teff flour at all, but you say it's one of the most nutritious grains in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about Teff?
Yeah, Teff is an ancient North African cereal grain, and it's really you know, just nutritionally powerful. It's actually one of the smallest grains that it that actually exists. And, you know, it's used in traditional East African cooking in Ethiopia and Eritrea. But one of the things, you know, the way that I help people connect with Teff is actually the main ingredient for injera, which is the Ethiopian kind of soured flatbread that's used to, you know, traditionally eat Ethiopian food when you have the food served on the injera. Yeah, exactly. You take it and you dip it in the bread. And so, you know, that's what teff is, you know, injera is made from teff. And it has this mild, nutty flavor. It actually has lots of calcium, protein, and fiber. And in addition to making, you know, being used for injera, people use it in porridges and stews, in baked goods. And so in the spirit of Afrovegan, my new book, with kind of doing these culinary clash-ups where I like to take ingredients and flavor profiles and classic dishes from different parts of the African world and just bring them together, I really wanted to, you know, experiment with using teff flour as the primary base for biscuits, which are, you know, one of the kind of staple dishes in the American South. So kind of bringing the American South and East Africa together with these biscuits. And for topping, what I do is I make this maple plantain spread. So using, you know, plantains, the sweet plantains, and then, you know, kind of cooking it down, adding a little maple syrup, some bourbon, and just making this gelatinous, delicious fruit spread that has the color, and some might argue the texture of butter, but then the sweetness of a fruit spread, and it's really good. Teff biscuits and maple plantain spread. That's one of my favorite recipes in Afro-Vegan, actually.
Mm-hmm. They look wonderful. Certainly one that I'm going to try. One of your other favorite ones here was the braised mustard greens, the slow braised mustard greens. Can you tell us what makes that such a standout for you?
Well, you know, so in the American South, I often joke about how, well, first of all, I feel like it's important for me to recognize that part of my work has been pushing back against this stereotype that all African-American cuisine and Southern cuisine is bad. Like, that's the stereotype, that it's all fatty, that it's all, you know, bad for you, it's artery clogging, it's blood pressure raising. And, you know, I really want to help people understand that when we think about the origins of African-American cuisine, you know, the true kind of farm-fresh, garden-fresh origins of it, it's replete with nutrient-dense, healthful vegetables like leafy greens like collards and mustards and turnips and kale and, you know, things like butter beans and sugar snap peas and pole beans and black-eyed peas and, like, all the type of foods that I think any, you know, Western-trained allopathic physician or naturopath or dietitian would say that we all should be including in our diet. And so, you know, one thing a lot of the older African-Americans would do is cook the greens. I say cook them to death, kind of tongue-in-cheek, because oftentimes people in the South will cook greens for a couple hours. The thing about cooking greens like that is that, because, you know, as a lot of people know, the more you cook fruits and vegetables, the more you kind of devitalize them and cook out a lot of their enzymes and nutrients. But, you know, the older people knew that when you cook your greens like that, it does make them more tender. And if you cook them that way, you have to drink the pot liquor, where a lot of the nutrients and a lot of the good stuff actually is. So, you know, I make this recipe in the new book, the braised mustard greens, in that spirit. And what I do is, and kind of, you know, going along with this whole culinary clash up, is I top them with my kind of dish inspired by this traditional South African dish called s'more tomatoes, which is a tomato and onion-based dish that, you know, used as a side dish or sometimes as a topping. And so I take onion, you know, fresh rings of yellow or white onion, and then I caramelize them for about 30 minutes, cooking them on low heat and a little olive oil for a long time just to bring out their natural sugars. And then I add some tomato paste, and then I use that to top the greens. So in a similar way that one might use, you know, a lot of times the older people, African-Americans, would put hot pepper vinegar or something of that nature to give the greens a little more acid flavor, to lift them up and give them a little more brightness. So that dish serves the dual purpose of, you know, the tomatoes on top of the braised mustard greens, giving them some more brightness, lifting them up, but then also just that tangy, delicious tomato onion mixture just makes it out of this world. So I said that was one of my favorite recipes in the book, because for me, taking such a mundane dish such as mustard greens that are braised in a vegetable broth, and then lifting them to a whole another level with this addition of the, you know, tangy onion tomato mixture, it just, I was really impressed with that myself, and I'm
rarely get impressed with all the recipes. I have to say, I'm really, you know, it's inspiring. It's really fun to, for me as a chef, to open a cookbook with so many new ingredients for me to play with, because, you know, I went to art school, not culinary school, and so, you know, the kitchen's become my palette, basically. And
nice.
You know, yeah, and so when you can add new colors and new ingredients, it's just, you know, as an artist, it just, you know, makes it that much more fun to experiment and play around. And you start your book
with all these wonderful combos.
You know, and most of them seem pretty spicy. Is that a traditional thing in the African diet, a lot of spice?
Yeah, well, you know, peppers are used generously throughout, you know, Western Central Africa and a lot of African cultures. Peppers are used to, you know, give the meal a little punch, whether it's a hot pepper paste or some type of hot sauce that could be poured on it. And so, you know, I have a whole section in the book, spices, sauces, and heat. And so I include several recipes for hot sauces, from my mango habanero hot sauce to my spicy mustard greens, which is kind of a play on the traditional hot pepper paste, harissa, which is used in North African cooking, but I use mustard greens as the base for it to give it a kind of, you know, spiciness and that kind of mustardy punch that you get from the mustard greens. And a few others. And so I definitely want to give people that option of being able to add some punch and spice to the dishes. And then for the dishes where I might include peppers in the dish itself, or cayenne pepper or some type of heat, I you know, will most often give suggestions for, like, using less heat so that you can adjust it to one's palate, because some people just can't deal with heat. I lived in New Orleans, went to college in New Orleans, so I have, like, a high tolerance, and, you know,
right,
just I'm kind of enamored of hot sauces. But I do realize some people can't really take the heat, so I, you know, might say, well, if you can, you know, for people who can do more heat, you might want to use, you know, a whole jalapeno pepper. But for those who do less heat, you probably want to do a fourth of a jalapeno, and then you probably want to cut the rib and the seeds out, so to just, you know, have, like, a little touch of heat and not so much that it'll, like, blow your palate away or anything. But, yeah, I love heat.
Mm-hmm. I see that. And the grilled corn looks great, too. You know, you have so many different toppings that you can put on top of the grilled corn, and it just turns grilled corn into a whole other thing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times people default towards, you know, cooking corn, whether it's boiled or grilled, and then just kind of slathering it with butter. And, you know, I get that when I was growing up, and that was one of the main staples at our summer cookout, the grilled corn with butter, you know, slathered on it. But I just want to give people options and let people know that you don't necessarily have to, you know, use butter, and that some options for, you know, toppings or whatever ingredients that don't have any animal products can actually be really flavorful. For the grilled corn and recipe in my book, I actually use a pili pili sauce, which is this, you know, hot sauce that's used throughout Africa. It's pretty popular using African birdseye chilies and a number of other herbs and spices. And then the other option is the spicy mustard greens, that kind of mustard green harissa. And, you know, it's just, it takes it to a whole another level in your mouth.
It looks like
but
it.
Also aesthetically, they look really beautiful, right, with the green and the red on that yellow corn. I feel like it's nice to look
Absolutely.
At.
Absolutely. I'm going to do it. Absolutely, because I'm always doing, you know, vegetarian barbecues, because I also, you know, don't eat meat, and I do a little dairy, but I try to avoid it, and, you know, I have so many friends that don't, so it's always nice to have those options, and it's really, you know, so nice that you have this book to inspire people. So thank you. Can you share with us, before we end the show, share with us if you'll be in New York at all, speaking, or I guess you're touring with this book now?
Yeah, I am touring, and I'm actually kind of winding down towards the end of the tour. I have to start getting settled back at home because my wife is going to be having, we're having another child in June.
Oh,
really,
congratulations.
Thank you so much. And then I actually have come back. I've gone to New York twice this year, but I'm coming back in October. I'm going to be doing an event at the James Spirit House in Manhattan, and then I'm planning to do a couple of other events while I'm there, so I will definitely be back in October, and if people want to find out when and where, I will be. You can check out my website, www.bryant-terry.com, and yeah, I would love to meet some of your listeners. And
thank you. Well, you'll meet me. I'll be there. And thank you so much. I'm sorry for the confusion at the beginning of the show, and for everybody out there listening. Yeah. Thank you, everybody out there listening, for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green and my guest, Bryant Terry. Have a great rest of the day, and I'll be with you again next week.